This is the Taser Update for August 28th, 2016. I'm Free Quoted Alpha.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
I'm Chris Elogi.
And I'm Lee Lamb.
It's been a pretty eventful week, to say the least. Sony's been busy. SNK has gotten, well, what I consider their pride and joy out the door.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of good stuff to talk about, and I think we just, let's jump into it, because I don't have a heck of a lot of time today.
Oh. <laughs> Yeah.
So that whole moving thing. You know, moving sucks? Should point that out. So, yeah, what have we been playing? Me, KOF 14. Pat.
KOF 14.
Yeah, we'll talk at length about that.
It is a statement game, if ever I've seen one.
Yeah. So, Brandon, how about you?
Tales of Exilia, still.
Yeah.
And Unimeko When They Cry. I finally found a good working copy in English.
Ooh.
So, this is the other When They Cry franchise by 07th Expansion. It's only tangentially related to Higurashi, but is just as good. So what about you, Chris?
So I'm still playing Alien Nation. Managed to get into the middle brackets of that league, so I'm going to stay for another week. Still have a few more hours to go, so I might double check, make sure the few people that are right around my area don't suddenly play it and pass me.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I really like about one of the new items, the laser gun, is that enemies that are coming at you from the direction you're pointing at can't actually hit you.
Mm-hmm.
So that offers a nice little barrier while I'm doing damage to them, compared to every other weapon where generally unless you are actively firing, you're not pushing enemies away or anything like that. Playing more of that. Hitman, they put out their fourth episode in Bangkok. I just started that a little bit ago. That so far seems pretty cool. It centers around a indie rock leader who, I guess the little story behind it is that he had a woman in his penthouse suite, and she mysteriously fell off the ledge down to the ground below to her death, and he managed to get off because his father is incredibly rich. And so you're tasked with killing him and the lawyer that specializes in getting people off in those sorts of situations.
Mm.
So this is sort of a big resort area. And so there's some new types of cops, sort of as far as their outfits are concerned, that are interesting. So trying to just learn some of the new visual outfits, sort of figure out, okay, these guys are the cops, these are security, you know, these are different kitchen or waiting staffs, things like that.
Yeah.
Managed to get into a pickle pretty quickly. Was basically just running up steps trying to get to some sort of safety and hopefully get things to reset, but that didn't really work out too well. Ended up finding this weird stalker in the top floor of this hotel, and which is a weird outfit for... It looks like he's a grunge fan from the 90s. Like sort of a plaid jacket like wrapped around his hips, like weird... shirt with a weird logo on it, which seemed to fool nobody. Because everybody still is like, there he is! Like gunned me down after I managed to knock out some people, just run up to him, clock him. Which is always fun to do when you know you're not going to go very far. Just see how far you get just knocking people out. I want to play more of that and see if I can actually beat it. But it's fun having a new playground area in this game after not having anything for a couple months. Also, I haven't gotten to it yet, but the Elusive Target I'm looking forward to playing because they're continuing their little cat-and-mouse game of changing up the the rules with each week just to try and keep people from being able to brute force their solution. So this time around, they don't actually tell you anything. They don't show you anything about this guy. They just tell you a little bit about him and let you go. So you kind of have to figure out what he looks like on your own, which is a pretty cool wrinkle. And yeah, it's so far that game's still really good. Looking forward to playing some more of that. The other game I've been playing is Human Resource Machine, which is basically like a big programming game. It's kind of designed around basic language. So it's a lot of basic phrases, and you're sort of taking these boxes with numbers on them from the inbox and doing whatever the level is specifically asking of you to figure out the right ones to put in the outbox.
Sounds a lot like the sequence, actually.
Kind of. So the areas I'm at right now is a lot of copying these boxes to these specific little spots they give you and sort of adding them to others to get specific numbers that it's like, oh, can you take these four numbers from the inbox and put their triples to the outbox? So it's like, okay, you have to copy the first number to a spot, add it to itself in the second spot, it's like two spots you add it to and then add them together and then add one again and put that in the outbox. It's pretty challenging, especially since I'm jumping into some of these more challenging stages right away where it's like, oh, you have to get the octuple of these numbers. And it's saying, hey, you have to use, you know, X amount of commands and sort of have X amount of steps as well. So really test your ability to sort of fine-tune the code and try and get through as quickly as possible. And what's cool is that they have a lot of neat little tools that you can use to, if you make mistakes, sort of trace your steps back, see where it broke.
Debugging.
Yeah. It's sort of this little step system where you can sort of fast forward through if you've obviously got the solution and just want to keep going through quickly. Or you can sort of say, hey, go back to the last command or the last command and sort of rewind a little bit like that and sort of tweak your stuff, which obviously will become a much more useful thing when it gets more complicated. But right now it's I'm like 7 or 8 stages in. And it's doing a good job of making me
making your brain hurt.
Yeah. Sort of rethink what I'm doing and trying to make the code more efficient. Which is pretty cool. It's on Wii U and it's on the PC.
Steam, I think.
Yeah. It's from the same people that did World of Goo. And I forget what their other game is. Been playing it on my Wii U because I think that's a pretty good way to play it on the touchpad.
Yeah.
There. The other game is Little Inferno, which is a weird little game about burning stuff.
Yeah, I remember that. I like that game.
Yeah, it seems real simple. It seems like this is going to be the same way where it seems like there's no story at all, but as you play more, something unfolds and then becomes like a bigger part of it later on.
Yeah. Little Inferno got really dark really fast.
Yeah, it got to a point where you're like, where other people in that area were like playing the same game and setting their houses on fire.
Yeah.
And then you find out other things that are going on, which is pretty cool. And yeah, that's pretty much it for me. So how about you, Lee?
Pretty much just WoW and work.
Yeah.
One of those weeks.
One of those years, it seems like.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess we'll get to KOF 14 then, since a couple of us have been playing that, and there's a whole lot of news surrounding it. So, may as well jump in there.
Yeah. I guess the first bit we can talk about is the R&D1 did a pretty good interview with Famitsu that was interesting. We got the link in the show notes. There were a few items of note that we can touch upon here. First off was Yasuyuki Oda pointing out that he would rather reboot classic SNK franchises than resume them from where they were, which makes sense because most of them haven't seen a sequel in nearly two decades.
Yeah.
So it's probably better to just start over from scratch and kind of rebuild the mythology and just the character base of each series.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Which is weird because in the case of KOF 14, he actually did both.
Yeah. Well, it was KOF 14 felt like a pretty standard first game in one of their trilogies.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, it's very well aware of its past, you know.
And yeah.
Even making light of it in some instances.
Makes reference to past story arcs. And one thing I found kind of interesting was that you had a character roster that pretty much ignored anything that was made after that team was dissolved.
Yeah.
But you get playing the story mode and you see so many references to the Aruze years and the Playmore years that they haven't forgotten. And clearly they've been paying attention even when they were no longer the ones making the series.
Yeah.
So I found that to be a little bit interesting.
Yeah.
Another note from the Famitsu interview is Kuroki said that the 50-character workload was kind of annoying for a first effort back, but that it did work out in the end. It was just kind of salty throughout the process. I suppose he's the art director.
Yeah. So. You got to do character designs for 50 characters, you know.
You want granted, what?
Yeah. You know, granted, some of those are, you know, already well established, so there's not that much to do. But still,
well, a lot of them got redesigned, too.
Yeah. But, yeah, 50 characters in their first game out, we'll talk a little bit about how that contrasts to what Capcom did.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I'm glad that they had the motivation and the discipline to actually pull this off. Because
the raw talent.
Yeah, because, I mean, it could have gone so horribly wrong. And, you know, when we first saw those teaser trailers, neither of us were particularly, you know, salient about it.
Oh. I was just overjoyed that it was even a thing.
Yeah, but we were both like, this could very easily go bad.
Yeah.
And it didn't. Yep. So 50 characters going there. They also talked about how important smooth frame rate and online performance was.
Yeah, that's another thing that kind of contrasts with Street Fighter V in both good and bad ways.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because the online came in a little hot, but the way they developed it, it'll be easily patchable, which is on the way, I should point out.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong. I mean, it's not terrible as it is. It's just it's not as good as it could be. If I was going to compare it, I would kind of compare it to MK10 before they went GGPO. It's more like that.
Yeah.
So,
which was not bad either.
Yeah, which is not bad. It's just, but you know, it just goes to show their commitment when they're like, you know, it's what we got is okay, but we know we could do better.
Yeah.
So,
in a sense, it has a smaller version of the under construction sign that Street Fighter V has on it. There is still some stuff that they got to build, but the foundation is solid.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one thing I can definitely say about KOF 14 is you actually get a complete game here.
Yeah.
You know, I talked about it in my review. We got, you know, full story mode for, well, everybody. I kind of like
hilariously.
Yeah. There's obviously the canned cutscenes that are in there, which you can skip if you don't really care too much for them.
They touch on some interesting things at times.
Yeah. And there's also, of course,
they pick their interactions well.
Yeah. Some of which, yeah. King and Ryo come to mind, and
that was amusing.
It's like King's like, is he actually flirting with me?
Or clueless Ryo?
Yeah. So they got that. I can't even say how thrilled I am to actually be playing a complete KOF game that, you know, doesn't seem to be burdened by so much of the baggage that KOF has had in the past few years.
Yeah. KOF 12 just being kind of a vertical slice of whatever they had developed at that point. KOF 13 being just a little too nutty for traditional consumption.
Yeah,
fantastic game, but...
Yeah, but it got so mired in its own systems that it was just too much. I mean, there's still some of that in 14, but...
They cleaned it up real good.
Yeah, they cleaned it up. They got rid of a lot of the extraneous stuff that really was, you know, just kind of getting in the way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what else we got going on here? Oh, yeah, they're doing
World Championships.
Yes. So SNK's actually in a position now to do a World Championship. They've got, you know, financial backing from that Chinese company, the U Millennium.
They're using it well.
Yeah.
So now we're getting SNK-sanctioned World Championships in 2017. Details haven't come in yet, but the hype is there right now. I think they could really come out and make a legitimate competitor to Capcom Cup or equivalent.
Do you think we'll see the regional and international circuits start picking up KOF 14? Like, you know, final round and
I sure hope so.
You know, Evo.
Well, I look at how much support King of Fighters 13 got, and this game has even way more hype than that. So there really shouldn't be any issues whatsoever.
Yeah, I'm certainly hoping that it gets picked up on that one of the Evo 2017 slots is KOF 14 because it definitely deserves to be there.
I'm sure it'll get at least 1 year, and then we'll see how the hype goes and what kind of turnout we get.
Yeah.
Hopefully, you know, if it goes the way 13 did, there shouldn't be a problem as long as people keep coming for it. And the way everyone involved with SNK is talking, it's more likely we'll see King of Fighters 15 before 14 has a chance to wear out its welcome.
Yeah. 3-4 years.
That's about what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
I think we're going to see Oda's team go off and make Garo 2. I think we're going to see Neo G's team go off and make a new Samurai Showdown. And then once those are both out and, you know, fully released to the public with all the DLC and whatever they might have in the pipeline for them, then I think they're going to put their heads back together and work on King of Fighters 15.
Yeah.
But the way Oda in particular is talking, like, he never wants to not be working on a fighting game. Like, he wants SNK to be as prolific as they were in the 90s. And that is, if the King of Fighters 14's timetable is any indication, I don't see why they can't do it.
Yeah. I just hope they don't get oversaturated with fighting games like they do and eventually, like, branch out to other genres.
Yeah.
You know, they got the talent for it now, so...
I think it has to be self-aware enough that if there is that saturation point, then we'll at least know what the top tier of games is and then the stuff that's just out there for people to pick up and explore as they will.
Yeah. Yeah, so, but I wouldn't mind them going back and doing stuff like, you know... Oh, crap. well, cross swords wouldn't be bad. Maybe yeah. bring back some of the ADK stuff that they used to do. Ninja combat, maybe, but actually done properly.
Oh man!
You know, I wouldn't mind a couple of horizontal beaters, beat 'em ups. Lord knows we don't have enough of those anymore.
Maybe see them bring back their sports line.
Yeah, Baseball Stars revival. That wouldn't be bad.
Well, Baseball Stars 2 just came back to Steam a few months ago.
Yeah, never know. So on the tech front, you got a couple of notes that you wanted to do.
Yeah, one of the things that it rubbed some people the wrong way, but I think it was kind of a step the KOF had to take. That smorgasbord of jump options has been whittled down a bit.
Yeah, it's down to 3 now.
Yeah, super jumps are gone, hyper hops are gone. This kind of eliminates much of what I've had been calling from the KOF games, called a mute button, which would basically just be a fifth button where you hold it down and it disables your dashes, or if you jump, you'll just get a hop. If you do a super jump, you'll instead get a hyper hop. Basically, just something that would give you an alternative way to input the stuff that the really execution-heavy mobility options.
Yeah.
And now that we have super jumps and hyper hops out of the way entirely, now I don't think that's going to be so much of an issue. So that's solving the problem in a way that I didn't really think they would even consider.
Yeah, just pare it back a bit is basically what they did, you know. They got low, medium, high jumps. That's
it still feels great.
Yeah, works well for me.
I have to say I'm not a fan of the new Raging Storm input. I miss the pretzel.
Yeah.
Just because they went with the Orochi Nagi input and didn't nerf it at all. So the Orochi Nagi input is fairly simple. It's a quarter circle back, half circle forward, and punch.
Yeah.
What this means for Geese players is that anyone with 3 stalks of meter and 2 brain cells to rub together now has access to the most purely intimidating anti-air in the history of fighting games. So we'll see how that plays out, but right now I'm just not feeling it.
Yeah.
Anyway, story
as stuff. As someone who couldn't do the pretzel to save my life, I approve of this change, but, you know, that's just me.
Yeah. Well, more or less you were supposed to buffer it.
Hmm.
That's why you had that that long-distance roundhouse kick. At least that was one of my favorite things to hide Raging Storm behind.
Yeah.
Which, strangely enough, has been moved to forward and light kick. So,
yeah.
Story stuff. So the main thing we're finding out about the story arc is that this fire entity that appeared in the trailers gets defeated and shatters into a whole bunch of different parts. Each one becomes a resurrected person. Obviously, this is going to be a central plot point as the story arc progresses into King of Fighters 15 and what have you. Pretty interesting implications already. You had Iori's team ending that saw him, Chizuru Kagura, and Kyo go to Belgium, and they found Orochi. Weakened because he didn't have a host. So obviously Chris was not resurrected from the new face team in 97. Otherwise, that probably would have been pretty bad.
Yeah.
So they just basically murder Orochi on the spot, which was amusing. You had the official invitation team ending where Kukri just leaves and goes off to I forget where and meets up with Elizabeth Blanktorch, who isn't on the roster for this game. And they find Ash Crimson in one of these craters that where one of Versus' pieces landed.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing those three are going to be a team for next game. And then you'll probably have Antonov filling his spot for the official invitation team.
Yeah.
So at least that's my speculation. Nelson's Benefactors. I'm not sure if you've seen the South American team ending, but basically it turns out that the people who provided Nelson with his prosthetic arm actually orchestrated the accident that cost him his arm in the first place, and now he's like a test subject for them unwittingly. So that's probably going to pull back the curtain just a little bit on who the main villain faction is going to be for this story arc, but we haven't really seen enough of them to know what they're about yet.
Yeah.
So, but that was something that I found interesting and will probably get some attention as the hype eventually for King of Fighters 15 approaches.
Yeah.
The villain team ending.
Which was hilarious.
Yeah. I don't think this is going to get built upon much, but it definitely got very Beavis and Butthead Do America.
Yeah. I could definitely see SNK doing like a webcomic with this.
Oh, yeah. That would be perfect, actually.
Or at the very least a Four Coma series.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
So, Brandon, did you see it yet?
No, but people have told me.
Yeah.
So basically you have Xanadu, who's the third prisoner that broke out with them from Southtown Jail. And they won the tournament and everything, and Xanadu, they're out in the middle of nowhere because they're still on the run.
Yeah.
And Xanadu just casually sticks the prize check in the campfire. And he does this before Chang and Choi even realize it, and it's already burnt to a crisp when they figure it out, and then he starts babbling about metaphysics and potatoes and things. And that's kind of the moment of dawning realization where, yeah, he didn't break out of the same ward they did. And now they're stuck out in the middle of nowhere with him, with no money.
Yeah.
This has to be something they build upon in the future because
So, I mean, Chang and Choi are weird, but Xanadu just takes it to another level entirely.
Yeah, he broke out of the psych ward. There's no question. Chang and Choi are just crooks.
Yeah.
But, the Kyokugen team, their ending has just a bunch of them hanging out at Takuma's restaurant, which I guess is his new thing. And there's just an exchange at the end of that team's ending where Ryo mentions in passing to Kushnet Butt from Garo Mark of the Wolves that he's thinking of leaving Southtown. And Butt says that he'll join him. So that suggests to me that that's going to have some implications for whatever Garo sequel they finally end up working on.
Or it could be a foreshadowing of 15's team.
That's true, too. Wow, that would be an interesting dynamic. Although if it was Garo 2, I don't think it's not the first time Ryo's been in a Fatal Fury game.
No.
Because he was in Fatal Fury Special.
Yeah.
But, that was just a little subtle kind of mention that stuck out to me.
Yeah.
One more thing I want to mention about Verse. We've already mentioned what exactly happens when he gets defeated. And the cast has agreed that was not his true form. That he did not completely manifest. You hear the Akari team talking about that. You hear Geese Howard talking about that. Geese has some scrolls that contain some kind of prophecy about Verse, which is the entire reason the Southtown team entered into the tournament in the first place. Hmm. What I found interesting was that Verse, when written in katakana, which is, I'm guessing, how it was written out during concept stages of the game, you could get the word verse from it. You could also get the word birth, which is what he's doing, pretty much.
Yeah, that seems more likely.
That's just kind of the linguistics geek in me coming out, and it just makes me wonder some of the discussions that might have taken place through localization. But yeah, that's the story arc stuff I thought was most noteworthy. Did you have anything you wanted to mention?
Not really. You know, I just like how all the stories are basically, you know, kind of... There's some sense of seriousness in there, but the game is not really taking itself all too seriously as of yet. Which is good, because during those Aruza years, it was getting...
The Nests arc.
Yeah, that got really depressing.
Yeah, the Nests arc was pretty heavy. Hmm. Orochi arc did too, particularly 97, but it kind of had to, or else it wouldn't have been an effective story arc.
Yeah. I'm just glad they're not starting there. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure we'll get there at some point, but it seemed to be the usual crop of KOF endings. I was pretty satisfied with what they put forth. Probably forgetting a couple of things, but that's all right.
Yeah.
One thing I have to kind of bitch about, though. The Burn to Fight edition. So, my introduction to limited edition, collector's edition games is probably the cream of the crop to this day, is the working design stuff from the late 90s, the Lunars, Ark the Lad collection. Go into 2004, you've got Growlancer Generations. That is how you do a collector's edition. Everything is really well made. Everything fits into a box that will fit on your shelves with all your other games and stuff. You don't have to just kind of pull something from a larger box and put that with your games and separate everything. Not so much here. When I opened mine, the soundtrack CD case had pretty much torn up the innards of the cardboard innards of the box that had everything kind of positioned properly. And at this point, the whole box is pretty much useless. I'm going to have to just take out the soundtrack CD and put it on with my music, take out the art book, put it with my other books. The game's already on the shelf with my other games. But the steelbook is fine. I'm happy to see that something like that again. But I paid $80 for the Burn to Fight edition. I just expect better than to have the main packaging be a glorified shipping box.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like that hasn't become the norm, unfortunately. You see the same thin cardboard containers from other Atlas games, from Exceed, from NIS. It's just depressing when I think what we've come from, and now this is what passes for a collector's edition, you know?
Yeah, and then you got, Gaijin Works still doing it properly.
Yep.
And occasionally, some of the bigger publishers will actually get it right, but most often they don't.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think the entire, collector's edition type thing is as prevalent as it used to be. I mean, they're all doing them, but it's gotten so commoditized now, there's not really much point.
Yeah. And I think as people tend to forget about hard copy as a default, it's only going to get worse. Now, this is one of the things that I think we talked about this last week or the week before. Yeah, it was last week. Hajime Tabata is making Final Fantasy XV in such a way that people who buy the physical game will have everything that they need, whether they load it onto their PS4, Xbox One now, or 20 years down the road.
Yeah.
You know, they're getting a complete functional game, and so maybe we're seeing some kind of pushback against that trend, but it'll probably take a while before we see it start to properly correct itself, if it happens at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the box looks good. It just doesn't hold everything the way it's supposed to.
Yeah, they could have done better, at least with the internal dividers. Reinforced those probably would have helped.
Yeah.
But, anyway.
So the main discussion that has kind of surrounded this game in the weeks and months leading up to its release is how it will contrast with Street Fighter V in the scope of the fighting genres as it is right now. I will still stand by both games as being fantastic, but but KOF 14 certainly has everything that it needs to appeal to the types of gamers who were put off by Street Fighter V. And it almost feels like Street Fighter V kind of terraformed the genre landscape for KOF 14.
I don't agree with that at all, actually. Personally, I think that KOF 14 just released a complete game, like, you know, it's been doing for years.
Yeah.
You know, it's I well, think
we won't look at 12 when we say that.
Yeah, well, yeah. 12 was a bad time in all of our lives, I think. But basically what I'm getting at is there's a the expectation really should be that when you get a game, you actually get the game instead of just a part of the game. I'm not, you know, talking about episodics here because that's, you know, a whole different format entirely. But, you know, I think Street Fighter V is kind of an outlier and it tried to lower the bar. And I think, you know, you're going to see KOF 14 that didn't bite on that with that format. You got Injustice 2 that looks like it's going to be coming out complete. Yeah, I think Street Fighter V is going to be seen as an outlier.
When I talk about the bar, that's the terraforming that I'm talking about, because you have, like, if Street Fighter V had come out with all of the features, all the modes, the single character stories and everything that, as we think of them normally, King of Fighters 14 would probably look a lot more like just another game on the shelf.
Yeah, it would look like another KOF.
They kind of succeeded in lowering the bar, but they did it to their own detriment.
Yeah.
Because now you've got KOF coming out, and it's going to knock it out of the park.
Hmm.
You know, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well, I guess if you frame it that way, then yeah, I got to agree with that. You know, granted,
you just set up a situation for KOF to step in.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of, I think it's kind of sad, actually, with the way that Street Fighter V has been going. Granted, you know, the gameplay is fantastic. I mean, I can't stress that enough. We both know how good that game plays.
Yeah, I still have to call it a top five game in the series.
Yeah.
You've got your Untouchable, Super Turbo, Alpha 2, Third Strike. But after those three, I think you can slot Street Fighter V in right there and make a really good case for it.
Yeah, but the whole issue is that they just burned half of their audience.
Yep.
They focused so heavily on the competitive gamers, which is, yes, it's a pretty big deal. You know, there's money there. But that's a very small section of the Street Fighter audience. And I don't care what Capcom is gonna say about that. You know, that's the high-level competitive players are just not enough of them to sustain a complete game like that.
Yeah, it's not so much tying it to like competitive gamers, it's more tying it to their esports league thing that they had to get that game out before that started.
Yeah, if it had been for Capcom Cup, they could have delayed it indefinitely.
It's like the reason why movie games generally stink, because they're trying to get it out before release instead of when the game is potentially ready.
Mm.
So they had to sort of cut features out just to get it out there. And by the time they actually start getting those in, people have lost interest.
Yeah. Yeah, there's also the fact
hold on. The problem, too, though, is that, yeah, they did do it for Capcom Cup and everything else like that, and I understand that, and I'm involved in it. But at the same time, this is a product. Like, yeah, it doesn't matter it doesn't matter how they approached it or what their timelines were or anything else like that. I mean, Capcom, for all their bluster and all their talk and everything else like that, was saying that, you know, this was going to be a game that was similar to, you know, in terms of a long tail, like a MOBA or something like that. And they really shot themselves in the foot, because there's more than just the competitive player out there. And we're in a time frame now, as far as gaming goes, where people are seeing incomplete products put out regularly. And I think that we're hitting a point, too, where the consumer is losing their taste for that. Like, who basically, I mean, in a lot of ways, Street Fighter was a $60 early access title for a tournament. I mean, and that has hurt them. I mean, the fact that we're sitting here having a conversation about how the game that's going to ship on the disc is the complete game for Final Fantasy, or that, you know, KOF actually seems complete. We shouldn't be having these conversations. And the fact that we are is really crazy. And I think it speaks to the state that the industry is in. I mean, look at, I don't know if you guys have been following No Man's Sky, but I mean, there are people now that are asking for refunds that have played the game for 30, 40, 50 hours because it just stops working. You know, and this is a game that had been delayed and had been hyped to all hell and everything else like that. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, a lot of the stuff that was promised with it didn't come out with it, and they're adding it later. So, you know, there has to be a level of accountability from these companies for the products that they put out, or they need to shut their mouths about what they're actually going to put in the product until it's released. Blizzard has the same problem. I mean, you guys have heard me harp on it for months about how Warlords of Draenor is the most incomplete thing that Blizzard has ever made. By far. And yet they still put it out, and they still wanted to charge people $15 a month to play the game. So, I mean, that's the state that we're in, and it's, I think everyone should point it out more and should be even more intolerant of it, regardless of whatever the situation is. I don't care about Capcom Cup, and neither does the average person that is on the street and going, wait a minute, I just paid $60 for this, and it's not even finished?
Yeah, that's why I think Hitman is did so well, is that initially they were going to do that same thing. Say, hey, give us $60, we'll give you half the content, we'll finish it later. And then they said, wait, no, we need to do this differently. And came up with their episodic model that has led to pretty much mostly positive feedback, where it further emphasizes the replayability of stealth games, where you get to mess with the systems, explore the levels, replay it over and over again for the various sort of unlockables and such that they do with that game. And in the end, you're not like, well, where's the rest of this game? You're like, well, I got a ton right here. I'll keep playing this for the next couple weeks, and they'll put out a new episode then. And it sort of fits that genre really well, but I don't know how you do that with a fighting game at all. Sort of thing where you have to come out with at least a strong full feature set first, and then release more. Not this, like, well, here's a couple of the things you expect. We'll get the rest of it out later when you guys stop caring.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, part of this is, part of it, too, is a milestone issue. I mean, You know, I work for a software company, and one of the things that we do see is that when you work with developers and everything else like that, I think developers tend to be really straightforward about what the timeline should be. And a lot of times, I think you see this in the game industry a lot, is that, and you see it with the movie industry as well, right? Or really anything that you put a deadline on. Somebody sets a deadline, and then everybody panics because there's a bunch of roadblocks that come up on the way to that deadline. And it's even crazier with game design and software design in general because of the milestones that you have to hit and everything else like that. You know, and it's very possible that for Capcom, especially with Street Fighter, you know, they came barreling down to the wire and, you know, they had to make a choice. I don't think it was the right one. But, you know, there's absolutely no way there wasn't a manager going, look, just ship it. I mean, we see that all the time.
Oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure I know who the manager was, too.
Yeah. Part of it also, I think, is a mindset issue. I think there was kind of a different philosophy going on over there. I think instead of trying to deliver, you know, a lot of single-player content for Street Fighter V, that what Capcom really wanted to do was turn those people who typically played the single-player modes into competitive online players. It didn't work.
Especially not without the network behind it.
Yeah.
They had frequent online issues. Your fight money that you're going to use to spend on these future characters and such wasn't even really working to the point where they had to give you free characters because they couldn't charge you for it yet.
Hmm.
It's like that whole system where, you know, here's the content, we can't actually charge you for it yet, so just hang on to it for a little while until we can actually ask for the money for it.
Yeah.
It's like that's not how you're going to do it, especially for a fighting game.
Nope. Yeah, it's like, it's not like we can't charge you. They very literally couldn't charge, but they didn't have the
infrastructure. Then they just threw it away and said, just use your PSN or Xbox.
Let's just do that instead.
Steam money.
Yeah.
Which any of us could have probably told them from the beginning.
Yeah, why reinvent the wheel when it's already there? But, yeah, this isn't really about, you know, shouldn't be about how Street Fighter V kind of made its errors, because we've discussed that to death. I just want to focus on how nice it is that KOF 14 is out, and it actually seems to be getting a favorable reception for once. You know, 13 had its detractors. I'm not seeing much of that with 14.
Yeah. This is the most hype I've ever seen behind a KOF game, and that's actually saying something, because 13 did have its detractors, but it still probably had the most hype I'd ever seen, at least within the fighting game community, leading up to a KOF release. So to see 14 even build further upon that and really, you know, drive the message home that this is the original SNK, that they're back, and, you know, they released a statement game to support that.
Yep.
Yeah, especially when that the original reveal, if you guys saw a lot of the feedback, everybody's like, what, 3D? Fuck this. This is going to be terrible. Now come out, and it's actually pretty good.
Yeah.
And then Oda actually touched on that by saying that they wanted to make a 2D. But if you look at the developers that are coming up out of college, the talent that's out there to be hired, there aren't a lot of 2D artists among them anymore.
No.
And that kind of forced King of Fighters 14 to go off in the 2.5D direction. And they seem to have made the most of it.
Maybe they should have figured out how to do that. Maybe they figured out that Guilty Gear tech, where it's 2D, 3D look.
That Guilty Gear tech is Ishiwatari is a freak.
Yeah. Very few people can pull that look off.
He did things with that game that only he could do.
Yeah.
They could probably make money just licensing that out to these other companies.
Well, no, I don't even think it's something that they could license out. It's just straight up work.
Yeah, because they are. I mean, Guilty Gear is using 3D models, but the way that they're constructed and shaded, you really and wouldn't animated. Know it. Yeah, because they're animated that like 2D models.
That is just work.
That's sort of like the original Naruto games on PS3, where those games look just fantastic, but then you figured out all those weren't actually 2D.
Yeah. So, yeah, KOF 14, we like it. I'm going to be playing it a lot while I wait for my internet to be reconnected. So,
putting a more positive spin on the Street Fighter comparison, I think everyone who was put off by Street Fighter V owes it to themselves, owes it to SNK, really, to go out and pick up King of Fighters 14, support King of Fighters 14, because this is the game that everyone's saying Street Fighter V wasn't.
Yeah.
So that...
For one thing, it actually has an arcade mode.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Well, story, arcade, kind of the same thing. It's a story mode that plays like an arcade mode.
So yeah. Just
put it that way.
The only meaningful difference is that if a second player hits the start button, nothing will happen.
Yeah.
Or options button, as it were.
Yeah. But it has a CPU versus.
Yep.
And trials for 50 characters.
Props to whoever came up with trials for 50 characters for launch. That is insane.
Yeah. So along, to go along with that, SNK also dropped 17 Neo Geo soundtracks on iTunes. If you've ever wanted to pick up the Garou Mark of the Wolf soundtrack or the 98 soundtrack, you can go and pick that up on iTunes or listen. You can even stream it on Spotify. They're all there too.
Every King of Fighters from 94 to 02, so there's some really good music in there. Samurai Showdown, both Last Blades are in there. I think Metal Slug 1, 2, and 3, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. See, you listening, Nintendo? Because this is the kind of stuff that you need to be doing.
There's tons of people that are saying, let me give you money.
Yeah.
Instead of stealing them from YouTube channels.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's true.
It is very true. we want to give them our money, but Nintendo would just much rather just steal it from us anyway. How sad is that? Anyways, so right after finished up last week, the leaks started showing up about the PlayStation 4 Slim. Turns out it's a thing. They've seen it. It's basically a smaller PS4. Not a whole heck of a lot to say.
Also, doesn't weigh a freaking ton.
No.
One isn't going to end up in any evidence rooms.
No.
Yeah, it's fairly light. They moved the hard drive enclosure to the back now.
Sort of like the PS2.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I was wondering how that was going to even work, because it doesn't look like the top comes off, but yeah, it's just a door in the back.
Sort of looks like a big Apple TV.
Yeah, with a DualShock 4 that you can hang off it. Don't think anybody's here is really going to opt for one of these, because...
Not if there's going to be another part to announce pretty soon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This seems like the thing for the people that don't care, just want whatever's cheapest.
I think they have to get the prices down pretty hard, fast.
Apparently a part of this whole story is that somebody stole one of these.
Ooh.
I think the person that sold it stole it, potentially. So the guy that is the one that, like, Eurogamer and whoever else, like, contacted to get more information or pictures or whatever was more legit.
Yeah, because Eurogamer actually went to that dude's house to see it work.
Yeah, I think he was. I think this guy.
Spicy.
Yeah, I'm guessing this guy is sort of the victim of the back of the truck seller.
Yeah, he just
doesn't know where it came from, but the person that got it probably stole it. Yeah.
He bought it on an auction site. So,
yeah, because this thing isn't out for probably a few more weeks.
Yeah. So I'm guessing this is something that came around right before Sony were to announce both A, the Scorpio, and B, a price drop.
Yeah.
Scorpio. Der. Neo.
Yep.
That's Microsoft.
The PS4 Scorpio.
Yeah, I'm guessing that...
the old six-flop bone.
I'm guessing the complete picture will... will come into view when the Neo is announced, and I'm sure the PS4 Slim will be accompanied by a noteworthy price drop.
Yeah, because, yeah. I mean, September 7th, they're doing an event. They're not going to just do an event for a revision of the PS4.
No.
They're going to show new stuff there.
Yeah, probably announce a couple things, sort of, just probably hardware-wise for the rest of the year, to at least. Yeah.
And it'll be like a month... It'll be like a month away from PSVR, too, putting that out there.
Yeah, just remind people that PSVR is still a thing. It's coming out soon.
Oh, my wallet.
Yeah, those power plugs for the UK is weird as hell, these pictures.
Yeah, they're also like the safest power plugs ever designed.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, it's just the easiest way to tell it's not North America.
Yeah.
It's like, what the hell is this weird plug?
Yeah.
We can't have those over here.
No, because
that's Tommy stuff.
Because we've been using the ones we have for too long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to want to rip their houses up just to put new ones in.
Same reason we didn't really do well with Metric.
Yeah.
We got to change all these signs in our cars.
Except, the Metric system can't electrocute you, and your power plugs can.
Yeah.
That's a thing. Yeah. Anyways, PS4 Slim, it's coming out. Don't think any of us are really surprised by this.
Nope.
And it looks kind of ugly. So,
yeah. I am disappointed.
Yeah.
It just has a simple look to it.
Yeah. Looks like just another box.
Like flat matte black with the PlayStation logo on top.
Yeah.
You see in the bottom? The little rubber stops on the bottom are all PlayStation buttons. It's like all the little rubber feet are just triangle, circle, square, X.
Yeah.
Okay, that is kind of cool.
Yeah. Those are also the same button icons that are on Android now. I don't know why, but that's the design language that Android adopted. Anyways.
So, Pat, Stay tuned.
You put up a new video, Pat.
Yep. For the first time talking about something I'm not really personally invested in, but... we followed this story for long enough on the Day Zero update that I felt that putting in my two cents was worth doing. Obviously, last week at Gamescom, Metal Gear Survive was announced. Apparently, Konami didn't leave when they left. So, I'm completely apathetic about this game for what it is, but... And I'm sure a lot of people are too, just based on the news that has come out of Konami for all these months. But we can't pretend that this doesn't mean something. And so that's kind of what I explore in this video. It's a really short one, about 3.5 minutes, just kind of talking about what the implications might be and where they might go from here.
Yeah.
And it's not all doom and gloom, so. Take that for what it is.
Yeah, well, this could be the first step in Konami realizing that maybe they have to actually stay in the games industry, because that whole patchy slot thing didn't work.
Yeah. Well, SNK left patchy slot for a reason.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, maybe they got slapped in the face by reality and realized that they have to unfuck themselves post-haste.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they certainly left themselves a hell of a job to do, though, because holy crap, you couldn't possibly have...
Clean up aisle 4.
Yeah. It's like you went down an aisle and, set every item on fire, and then... Yeah. So, yeah. Konami, hopefully they'll get their act back together, but...
And if they really want to come out the other side of this, they will.
Yeah. It's just,
They're going to have to make some new talent.
They're going to have to make some new talent. They're going to have to convince people that it's actually worth working there. That's the big problem.
Yeah, when all your big names in the last 20 years left.
I can only imagine how it's going to be for whoever's job it is to play good cop.
Yeah.
They've got a lot of bridges that they have to unburn.
Yeah.
And you feel bad for the PR guys.
Oh, yeah.
Because they have to take all of the punishment, even though none of this was their decision.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
Yeah. Also means...
These are the same people who probably thought they were just going to be pitching Metal Gear Pachinko to various...
distributors.
Well, I was going to say establishments of ill repute, but...
I was going to say that maybe they just need to, you know, make connections with another Yakuza clan because this one isn't
working out
for them. I'm joking, but the somehow, way that corporations
mostly.
Work.
And,
you never know.
Yeah. The way Konami has run lately.
Yeah.
I mean, some of those stories, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So ZeniMax and Oculus is seems to be an ongoing thing right now.
Yeah, they've been warring for about 2 years now.
Yeah. What's new?
So basically, ZeniMax has put out a statement, sort of continuing this, basically putting out some damning claims about John Carmack, who was a former ZeniMax employee at id.
Yeah.
And sort of during his like last maybe year, he was very much interested in VR. Did a little demo of some prototype VR stuff with one Palmer Luckey of Doom 3 in VR, like really, really like cheap rig.
Mm-hmm.
But those people seem to really enjoy that, and seems like that led to the Oculus Rift Kickstarter. And there's obviously a lot of potential red tape as far as what did John Carmack work on his work computers? What did he do at home? And they're alleging that he copied thousands of documents from a computer at ZeniMax to a USB storage device before he left. Never returned those files or all copies of them after his employment was terminated. In addition, after Carmack's employment with ZeniMax was terminated, he returned to ZeniMax premises to take a customized tool for developing VR technology belonging to ZeniMax that itself is part of ZeniMax's VR technology. That's a little redundant.
Shit, that's not good.
Yeah.
Wow. So that is not something I expect to come from Carmack.
Yep. Yeah, except here's the thing. ZeniMax is bitching about this, but basically what John Carmack did was save himself some work. Because he did it once, he could have done it again.
Yeah, he's a proponent of open sourcing software.
Yeah.
And the other part of this is they say that Luckey increasingly held himself out to the media and the public as the visionary developer of Rift's VR technology, which had actually been developed by ZeniMax without Luckey's involvement. So they're saying that Oculus stole that tech from ZeniMax.
That one's going to be hard to substantiate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Essentially suggesting that he is kind of a fraud.
So where is ZeniMax's headset? That's exactly. The big, you know.
I think they're probably talking more about the stuff they're using to make, you know, the Fallout 4 and Doom VR stuff they're working on right now. Oculus at, I'm not sure who Ariba is, disseminated to the press that the false and fanciful story that Luckey was the brilliant inventor of VR technology who developed the technology in his parents' garage. In fact, the story was utterly and completely false. Luckey lacked the training, expertise, resources, or know-how to create commercially viable VR technology. Sort of basically
which is pretty why, deep. Yeah, which is why the Kickstarter headset was kind of bodged together.
Yeah.
Yeah, that they kind of forget that little detail.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one's going to go on and on. I don't think it's going to ever end up completely settled. There's going to be some sort of out-of-court settlement, some sort of licensing deal that gets placed. Basically, I think ZeniMax really just wants some Facebook money.
Yeah.
Because that's
pretty if there's much a more litigious company in the gaming industry, I'm not sure who it is. These are the guys that went on a long lawsuit with Mojang about scrolls.
Mm-hmm.
They also have bullied at least one indie team that I know of, the team that made Phoenix Fury.
Mm.
They had to change the name of that game Phoenix Rage.
Yeah, because
of Rage.
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody's going to use those two things.
Yeah.
God damn it.
I got to change it to Phoenix Fury.
One of those.
Yeah.
Oculus had a statement, this complaint filed by ZeniMax is one-sided and conveys only ZeniMax's interpretation of the story. We continue to believe this case has no merit, and we will address all of ZeniMax's allegation in court.
Hmm. Yeah, of course they will.
And so they're basically saying, we're not going to sit here and try and do a scorched earth campaign against this company.
Hmm. No.
Want to come after us? Come after us, bro.
And Game Informer has... seems like the whole complaint. 60 pages?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you want to get deep into some legal bullshit.
Yeah. Legalese.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
When a company is that used to litigation, don't...
the old
don't
saying
they
goes,
piss off some judges in the process?
They do, eventually. Depends on how many of those cases actually get to court. A lot of these just get settled.
Yeah. I wonder where this is going to be at.
I think best case scenario for ZeniMax is that it's going to get settled.
Yeah. Yeah. Mark will just, you know, fly to Texas and get him some money.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Pat, you put this next one here.
Yeah. So ESPN's... ESPN's involvement in esports continues with a really good article on Evo Moment 37.
Mm-hmm.
It's just good to see the continuing coverage. The butthurt coming from the comments section is always an entertainment.
Oh, yeah.
Keep crying, guys. We love it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, if any of you are currently listening to us, please send us your comments. We welcome your scorn.
Yes, we do. But it's a nice introduction to one of the
people think. We really don't.
Yeah.
But for people who aren't quite as initiated into the fighting game community as we might be, it's a good introduction on one of the really iconic moments that has taken place in the history of the genre.
Yeah, it breaks down basically the psychology that was going on. It breaks down the technical elements. It's a very, very complete write-up. Not the first that I've seen to do this, but it's actually done pretty well.
Yep, and it's what you would expect from ESPN on any competitive platform that you talk about.
Keep in mind, and I think people need to remember this, ESPN covers poker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, competitive poker.
Yeah.
And
when they talk about it, they actually go into the minute details of it.
Yeah. That is not exactly an physically intensive sport.
Yeah.
If it's competitive, it's a sport.
Yeah. No, I'd argue that competitive video gaming is more physically intensive than poker.
Yeah. Can be.
Yeah. Especially some games. Just...
Yeah, competitive DDR.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was going to say, we're probably over a decade removed from the first instance of a StarCraft player getting insurance on their hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, I think that's already happened.
No, it's happened a long time. I said we're probably a decade removed from it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, in the rear view. Like,
okay. Thought you were looking forward.
No. That is a thing that happened, and it happened... I remember we were discussing it on the Game Addicts board, so it has to be more than a decade ago.
Yeah. So, yeah. Good article to read if you're not familiar with the whole full parry.
I just want to see how... mainstream sports media would reflect on something like that.
Yeah. I think this is them testing the waters, basically.
Yeah. They're doing a lot of that.
More Dissidia news for the arcade edition.
Yeah. Going a little bit off the board here for their next character, Ace from Final Fantasy Type-0 is being added to the roster. This was announced on a live stream a couple nights ago, and really gets the point across that no Final Fantasy property is really out of bounds for where they'll draw the Dissidia roster from.
Yeah. Mm. Well, they want, what, a roster of about 50-some characters? So
they said really... that 50 characters were ready to go, and they're just more or less time-releasing them now. So really going to be interesting to see how the rest of this roster shapes up, because we're not even halfway through it yet.
Yeah. Yeah, if they're going for, you know, spin-off series, you know, then there's that leaves room for a whole lot of other things that they could bring in.
Yep.
Chocobo Racing.
the chocobos. That should be a thing.
Oh, here's an idea. You know that the famous car bonus stage from Street Fighter?
Yeah.
Chocobos.
You beat up Cloud's bike.
That's actually ridiculous enough to work.
Or beat up Cloud comes in, and then afterwards Cloud comes in, breaks down, going, "Oh my god."
Yeah, it breaks down, he walks off screen, everybody else just comes in, beats up the bike.
And that's when it got ugly.
Yeah. Yeah, this game's going to be... It's out in Japan, I think. Or is about to be.
Oh, it's been out for quite some time. Like I said, they're just time-releasing characters now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got quite a few to go.
Yeah. They're taking their time, but... It really feels like Team Ninja has put together something really special here.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, this is also an advantage of digital distribution, because all the machines are out there already.
Yep.
So I think this is one that's more up Lee's alley here. We got Hori here announcing that Dragon Quest XI development is done. Well, at least the scenario development for it is done.
Yes.
Yeah, the scenario is being plugged into the actual game now, and they're more or less putting the two together.
I'm so excited that I'll still have to wait like another 3 years to play it, but whatever. The fact that it's happening is wonderful. No, I think it'll I actually think they'll probably turn this one around quick. I hope Square gets off this thing of like, you know, if you buy this other game, then we'll make this other game. And then if you buy this one, we might port this other one. Like, you guys are liars and you're assholes. Just port the fucking games and make money off them because they're actually good games, rather than sitting here like, I don't need Hustle Man to sell me video games. I'm not sitting on the fucking corner anymore. I don't need this guy to be like, yo, you bought his watch, I'll give you two. Like, no. I'm not buying bootleg fucking DVDs or anything else like that. Just translate the fucking game and put it out. You know there's an audience for this shit. If your managers will actually readjust their expectations and don't expect this thing to sell a hojillion copies, everyone will be happy.
Yeah.
Everyone.
Yeah, Dragon Quest IX sold really well over here in the West, and somehow that meant they weren't going to put anything else out after that.
Yep. Yeah. I think a big part of the problem with Dragon Quest, and maybe because Final Fantasy has finally fallen off to a certain extent, that they're starting to reexamine it, but I think there's this idea like, Dragon Quest should sell X amount, and if it doesn't, then it's not worth our time. And it's just like, there's an audience for this. It's obviously not as broad as what Japan has. But them coming over here expecting this thing to sell like 9 million copies or something like that is like expecting the Xbox to sell well in Japan. There's a few people that want it, but not that many.
Yeah, it seems like a Wada thing where before he left, he was like saying Tomb Raider failed, even though it had its best launch month series had ever seen. Mm-hmm. Somehow that wasn't enough because it had to prop up all these other games.
Yeah.
It's like that sort of business handling is a good way to kill a bunch of franchises.
Well, it just reeks of being completely disconnected to what's going on, to what would actually sell. Like, you know, it would be the equivalent of thinking that the reason that Call of Duty 4 sold so well is because you shot people. Well, there's plenty of games that you can shoot people, and it still doesn't change the reason why Call of Duty 4 sold the way that it does. If you look at something like Overwatch, you could go, oh, well, Overwatch has sold 15 million copies. Obviously, the reason that it sold that well is because it has a character select. Like you can't. And that's sort of their. It seems to be like their thought process was just like, okay, well, one type of game with an RPG like system sold well, so every RPG should sell one. It doesn't work that way. And I think the other thing that Square has ignored for so long is that Enix really kind of missed the boat in America. I mean, do you guys remember the Super Nintendo era? Yeah. Nothing really came out from Dragon Quest. I mean, we had promises of things, but they never ever showed up. And then we ended up in the PlayStation generation with 7, and 7 looked like a low-rent 16-bit game. All of the build-up, all of the brand management that Final Fantasy had in America with 4 and with 6, and then moving into 7, Dragon Quest had none of that. But yet, Enix, and then, of course, now Square going forward, Square treated it like we had already had all the games. And we had this massive amount of hype, and that it should be standing toe-to-toe with Final Fantasy, but nothing was ever done to build that relationship here in America past the 8-bit era. And then they, you know, the next time we actually see, you know, a game that looked like it was current gen was 8, you know? And so then they took 8, and obviously people liked 8. I know it sold decently well. Then 9 came out. 9 sold for the region, sold really well. And they were like, yeah, not good enough. It's like, come on, man. I mean...
Yeah, 9 had to be published by Nintendo.
Yeah.
That was their start of, like, we're not going to publish anything unless somebody else pays for us.
Yeah, well, this is a bunch of horse shit.
And then hopefully enter Yosuke Matsuda, and they start to get some religion on that sort of thing. He was pleased with the sales figures of Bravely Default, which sold well. It did not sell a hojillion copies, so I'm guessing...
Well, the funny part about that is, though... With Bravely Default, they were like, this sold well beyond what we expected. And I think they said that when it hit top, like 500,000 copies. And they were like, this is great. And like, Dragon Quest IX sold like 1.5 million. And it was like, this is not great. Like, okay.
Yeah, times and minds change. So it's like, yeah, if they're now at the point where they're actually happy with 500,000, well, that's better.
That's a good sign.
Well, I think they have to look at the overall sales, right? Like, oh, excuse me. Oh, my God. That's awful. Sorry. I think they have to look at the overall sales, right? Like, for instance, when you look at the box office totals now, for America, they usually have, for a movie, they'll usually have, you know, stateside and then everywhere else. And, you know, typically nowadays, it's that worldwide gross that gets the movie over the profit line. You know, a lot of stuff that's getting put out now because of how big blockbusters are and things like that are not making all of their money back just on the U.S. run. And I hope that companies like Square and things like that can look at the overall product. Because, like, let's say, for instance, 11 comes out on the PS4. And let's say it sells 5 million copies total. 4 million of those are in Japan and 1 million are here. That's not a loss.
No.
You know, like... Is it, and I hope that they look at that, because they seem to sort of have this idea that previously that if it didn't sell the exact same way that it did in Japan, then it wasn't worthwhile. And that's just incredibly short-sighted.
Yeah.
Especially with a property that is beloved as Dragon Quest is all over the world. There just hasn't been enough that's been put out in that specific vein that people have wanted to buy. Like, I mean, you looked at... the Dragon Quest Dynasty Warriors game, and they were just like, hey guys, if you buy this, maybe we'll bring out, you know, maybe we'll bring out Dragon Quest 7 and 8. Like, these aren't even the same fucking game, man. Like, people that would buy this kind of game aren't probably going to buy the RPG and vice versa, unless they're just like, I like all things in this vein of X, you know? Like, my son really liked the Dragon Quest Heroes game. I'm over the Dynasty Warriors formula. I got over it 15 years ago. But that doesn't mean I won't buy 11. It doesn't mean I won't buy 7 or, you know, whatever. Anyway, you've heard me bitch about this many times.
Yeah,
11's got some interesting stuff going on because it's very much multi-platform. It's on Wii U, NX, PS4, and 3DS.
So 11 isn't coming to Wii U, apparently.
They canceled that?
Right now, what I'm seeing says, this is over at Operation Rainfall, says Dragon Quest XI is scheduled to release in Japan before the end of May 2017 on PS4, 3DS, and NX.
Because I remember that being Wii U and them confirming some sort of NX version.
Yeah.
And sort of reconfirming 10.
That.
I think they were saying it was going to come out on Wii U as well, but if it's not, that's a change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how 10 didn't come over either, because Final Fantasy 11 was their best-selling Final Fantasy game. It's like, hey, put another MMO out there and put it on a platform, put on a couple platforms. I think it was PC and Wii U over in Japan. Maybe yeah. Wii. It's like,
well, I think actually that probably would have been a mistake, to be honest with you. I think MMOs are in, as a guy that plays MMOs, MMOs are in a very, very weird place right now. And it's, at least, you know, stateside, it's very difficult for, with the exception of Final Fantasy and WoW, nobody's paying for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I and think...
And you've got a market saturation there with Final Fantasy and WoW.
Yeah.
Like there's probably not room for a third heavy hitter to step in.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah, because I don't think the MMO market itself is actually getting any bigger. I think what's happened is that MMO players are bouncing around from MMO to MMO, kind of like a ping pong ball, but yeah. The actual pool itself is not growing.
Especially as you can play most of them for free.
Yeah, I mean, it's just... And there's such a time commitment that nobody's playing two MMOs at once. Mm. So if I think Square probably also thought about, okay, we could, if we put out 10, or at least in my thought process, they would do this because it's intelligent, is that they would think, okay, well, we're going to put out 10. That means that people might jump from Final Fantasy XI or Final Fantasy XIV to play Dragon Quest X. And do we want that sort of attrition? Like, it's still a net, like, even for them. They're not losing anything. But you got to. But the other thing too with MMOs is that as people leave, other people leave. A big hook for MMOs is the social interaction. That's one of the biggest problems WoW has had, is that since there's so little to do, or since there's so very little group content with Warlords besides raids, a lot of people's friends stop playing. And then because their friends stop playing, they stop playing. And so I think Square probably also looked at that as a possible calculated risk. Like, if we put this out and, you know, if there's a group of, you know, if there's a guild that has 25 people in it and 7 of them leave to play 10, what's going to happen to these other people? Will they continue to play with the loss? Are they going to be able to, you know, that's something to consider if you're managing more than one MMO, you know, under your umbrella. And I think they had experience with that with 11, because I know plenty of people that jumped from 11 to 14 and did not go back. And of course that hurt 14, and of course 14, or excuse me, that hurt 11, and of course we know what happened with 11, so.
Yeah. 11 is no more.
Yep.
So. It's a mobile game now.
I have to just point this out. I've played plenty of Dragon Quest games, and Yuji Ori, he has to be always commended for the fact that he basically created the console JRPG.
And he's still with the franchise.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, Nihon Falcom put some stuff out before, but he is, like, one of the... And, I mean, the dude even invented the visual novel genre as well.
Hmm.
But that I have to add... Know. Yeah. The Portopia serial murder series. Yeah, that was him. But I have to ask... Really, how difficult is it to create a scenario for a Dragon Quest game?
It's true.
Like, seriously.
Mm. Yeah. Not that hard. Just have some slimes. It's all good.
Yeah, I think that's just a symptom of it being the first JRPG.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, well.
It is going to be a little more formulaic. If anything, it's an interesting contrast with Final Fantasy, which... just kind of wanders wherever it wants to its own detriment, and Dragon Quest that may not wander enough.
Yeah.
There's got to be a happy medium there, and neither one of them are striking it.
Yeah.
Final Fantasy was for a long time, but then, you know, 11, 12, 13, that was the end of that.
Yeah. Anyways, good news. The Toe Jam and Earl 4, which I think was a Kickstarter project.
Yep. Yep.
Has actually found a publisher now in Adult Swim. So,
perfect fit.
Yeah. We're going to see a Toe Jam and Earl 4.
Back in the groove.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Back in the groove.
Hopefully Adult Swim is also kicking the tires on a possible cartoon spinoff, because that would also be a perfect fit.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, Adult Swim's become a really good publisher for indies.
Yeah.
They had a lot of cool games under their belt.
Didn't they do Slane
maybe. I remember Broforce was them. No, Broforce was Devolver. Volgar, the Viking. I forget what other ones they have. Maybe their tags on this article points them out. Castle Doombad, Amateur Surgeon. Yeah, those are those guys.
Yeah.
Velociraptor. Okay, that's a good name.
Yeah, I'm gonna check it out because I have a whole lot of nostalgia for Toe Jam and Earl. 3 had some potential, but it just didn't quite deliver on it. So we'll see.
It did a good job of updating the tone of the series.
Yeah, you know, we'll see how Back in the Groove turns out.
Oh yeah, they published Headlander.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, Death's Gambit, Rain World, Westerado, Rick and Morty VR game, Duck Game, Rise and Shine, Desync. It's cool stuff.
Yeah.
Jazz Punk, that's them too.
All right. Yeah, just a quick tip here. There's a new Humble Bundle going on. It's Capcom. It's got PS3 and PS4 games in it.
Yeah, unfortunately they haven't made very many PS4 games. So it's mostly PS3.
Yeah, mostly PS3. But
it's like
a 45% off coupon for Street Fighter V, though.
Yeah, but
you pay
$15
for everything. You get both of the recent remasters of Resident Evil 1 and 0. Okami, Remember Me, Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo HD Remix, Lost Planet 3, Mega Man 9 and 10, Devil May Cry HD Collection, discount on the Mega Man Legacy Collection, and Street Fighter 5. You also get Puzzle Fighter 2, Strider, Wolf of the Battlefield, Commando 3, Final Fight, Double Impact.
Ooh.
So a lot of games for $15.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
Yeah. And a couple of discount coupons. So, I don't know. If you don't have Street Fighter 5 already, you can use the coupon for that and get it for half off.
I know those Resident Evil ones are $20 each, so there you get savings there and a bunch of free games with it.
Yeah. Yeah, no 1942, though, which is unfortunate, because the remake of that was actually pretty good.
I don't know if that came out on PS3.
Yeah, it did.
It might not be on PSN anymore, though.
Mm. Yeah, maybe it was.
I think there's been a couple games they've pulled. I don't know why, when they're properties they own.
Yeah. Who knows?
That's publishing for you.
Yep.
Might be, like, engine stuff. Maybe the engines are made on lesser license or something like that.
Yeah, maybe.
Some sort of licensing issue. They lost the license to World War II.
So all World War II games have to be pulled.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, PlayStation Plus news. Price increase.
Boo.
This sucks. Especially since they didn't actually bother to make a new post for this. They just kind of slid it into the Games for August post.
Yeah, this is the thing they've been kind of doing for the past year or so.
It's kind of the increasing the price equivalent of a end of Friday news bit.
Yeah.
And it's also just economy stuff with the yen just being out of whack. So it's causing the other regions to have to increase the price to make up for it.
Yeah. Still kind of sucks because, PlayStation Plus went from, you know, $49.99 to $69.99 for me.
Yeah.
That's a bit much.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big ask, especially, you know, if it was, you know, I don't know. I just kind of wish that the online play was just kind of included because that's really what I actually care about for PlayStation Plus. Yeah. So free games are nice, but it's really the online play that I actually want.
And you know those free games are going to be more scrutinized than ever now.
Yeah, they're going to have to be. People are going to ask, well, is this really justifying the price? And one thing I've noticed when I go to the website to get those PS Plus games, they make it very clear how much you would actually be spending if you were to get to buy all of those.
Yeah.
Because,
that sounds awfully defensive to me.
Yeah, they do it through their cart format. And they total up the value of the games, and then, you know, they add discount code, which gives it to you for free. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a thing they've been doing. One of the recent, upgrades for the site is just making the discount more clear.
Yeah.
Upgrades.
Upgrades. So yeah, it's PlayStation Plus. You're going to spend more money if you continue to subscribe, which I will not.
We're gonna know September's games next week, aren't we?
Yeah.
My PS Plus subscription doesn't expire until November, so I'm at least locked in until then.
Yeah, people are buying a lot of the 12-month cards for $40 or so.
Yeah.
So those sites are getting overloaded. To the point they're getting death threats because they're not getting it out fast enough. I'm just like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, people are getting death threats about everything now.
They're saving you $20 on this thing and you're fucking threatening to kill them.
That's
going to make them get it out faster.
Yeah.
I think one of the sites said, if we find out you're the one that's sent us death threats, we'll cancel your order.
Good.
Good.
Yes, they should. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, don't yell at somebody until you have the product.
Yeah. Because then you might not get the product. And you might also get law enforcement.
Make sure you redeem it first.
Yeah.
Then send the death threats. Then they can't take anything back.
Smashpad does not advocate death threats. So, other Sony news. We've got PlayStation Now is coming to the PC.
Yeah.
Kind of about freaking time.
Yeah, I can see it playing a lot better on PC than on console.
Yeah, because on the PC, you really didn't have access to these games at all.
Most of them.
Yeah, not most of them. Most of them are PS3 games, so if you didn't have one of those, well, yeah. Bigger news, though, is a Bluetooth adapter for the DualShock 4 controller, which also implies that the DualShock 4 controller will have proper drivers.
From what they say, it enables the ability to use all of the buttons on the controller, so the light bar, the touchpad, all that, if the game supports it.
Yeah, so, full, proper.
I think it's one controller per Bluetooth adapter.
Hmm. I could kind of see why that would be.
That'll be great for me because my USB cable sucks that I have to hold the controller in a specific way or else it like, disconnects.
Yeah.
So it's like, now I can just have this Bluetooth thing, just do whatever.
Yeah. So now you can connect your Xbox One controller via Bluetooth, via an adapter to your PC, and also have the PlayStation 4 adapter in there, too. You have all kinds of dongles. Yeah.
I got enough dongles with my mouse and keyboard.
It's rolling in dongles.
Well, that's what she said.
Yeah, the PlayStation Now stuff will be pretty cool to see. Especially with a lot of those games being either like Sony stuff or like PS3 exclusive, like smaller indie stuff.
Yeah.
I've been using that a lot on PS4 and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it works well. I think they're overpriced a little bit, but that's just me.
Yeah, they got over 400 games now, so that's quite a lot of games to have access to.
Yeah.
People should at least try it out. I'm sure they'll have like a trial for that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
And just so people know, they're not running on the PC. They're going to run like they do on a PS3.
Yeah, they're streamed.
Just because you throw in your 1080 in there, it's not going to make these games run at max resolution, frame rate, all that.
No, it's really going to be your network connection that's going to determine how well this works.
Yep.
Hmm. Yeah. So another Sony news, finally, PlayStation Network finally gets two-factor authentication.
Thank God.
How many years too late?
But let's see. It was 2011, so 5 years too late.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Well, better late than never, I suppose.
That's where the $10 went, guys.
Yeah. So, if you got a smartphone, you can enable two-factor authentication on PSN.
We joke, but this is a good thing.
Yeah, this is a very good thing. Yeah, just be careful because you may end up accidentally locking yourself out. If you don't do
that. At least it's secure.
Yeah, at least
nobody can get it if you can't. Nobody, get it.
Yeah, not even you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I'm sure probably if you call them, they can probably disable it. But yeah. If you value your PSN account, if you've got a lot of money invested in digital downloads, movies, music, games, of course, this is probably something that you're going to want to enable. It's not a huge hassle. You know, you might have to enter in another number after you enter your password, but it's good that it's there.
Yeah, I think the latest issues that have been going on is involving PayPal, which of course it does. PayPal's terrible with security. So there's some sort of loophole that people get to your account through PayPal and buy Neverwinter stuff. Somehow Neverwinter's.
So that's a new thing. FIFA.
That's the,
Jeez. I'm actually reading this correctly. Nintendo announces Nindy Summer Jam.
They've been doing the Nindy thing for a year or two now.
That's just like.
Looks like this is going to be a treat, though.
Yeah, they got a new promotion coming up called Nindy Summer Jam, which is for the next 5 weeks, starting on September 1st. They got Axiom Verge for the Wii U for first week, which we all recommend.
Yeah.
It was our game of the year in 2015.
Yeah.
So go play that.
Give Tom money.
Yep. On the 8th, it's Jotun Valhalla Edition. 15th is Noitu Love Devolution, Wii U and 3DS, Jotun's Wii U. Severed, Wii U 3DS, that game is great.
Yeah, we've been playing a lot of that on the PS Vita.
Yep, and it's cross-buy on that particular game, so you get both for one price. And September 30th is Azure Striker Gunvolt 2 for the 3DS.
Ooh.
So the first game was pretty good.
Yeah.
And all of those games are 10% off for the launch week.
Yeah, so kind of doing like PlayStation did with their Play campaign.
Yeah. Now, I'm not familiar with the middle three games, but you can't find better bookends for this promotion.
Oh.
Yes.
On the one hand, you have the Metroid game that Nintendo apparently refuses to make.
Are you mad about the most recent Metroid? Here's your game.
That's kind of ironic and sad.
It's true.
Now, on the other hand, you have basically the Mega Man game that Capcom refuses to make.
Yeah. So,
And which Inafune tried to make on his own.
Yeah,
that failed miserably.
Yeah.
Are you mad at Mighty No. 9? Here's a game for you.
Yeah. Yeah, if you want to actually play a version of Mighty No. 9 that works, try the PC version.
Now, whether or not that's actually going to.
I was going to say 20XX.
Yeah, that too. So, yeah, that's Nintendo's Nindy campaign. A lot of good games in there. So, if you got Wii U and 3DS, definitely want to check in there. More Nintendo news before we wrap up the show for the week. So apparently the NX is kind of important to Nintendo. And apparently it's going to benefit from the lessons that they learned from the messaging of the Wii U, or the lack thereof.
Sure. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
It doesn't have Wii in the name, so they're off to a good start already.
This is just sort of a case of I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah. Supposedly we don't actually know what the official name of the NX is going to be. It's still codename NX right now. It's not official.
Yeah, I
wouldn't
be
surprised if that was actually the name, though.
I wouldn't be surprised either, but I also wouldn't be surprised if it turned out to be Wii Me.
Or the Wii U 2.
Wii 3.
Yeah. Wii Me is probably the way they'd end up going.
Wii TV.
Yeah.
The super duper Nintendo.
Yeah.
I would actually go for that.
Yeah.
No, I still think it would be to their benefit to bring back the NES branding, but
yeah,
maybe not like that.
Yeah, probably not like that. Although that does set itself up for some pretty radical 90s style packaging that they could end up with, but
like Nintendo High Definition Entertainment System. Or
I think they should just call it the Nintendo.
Yeah.
The new Nintendo.
Yeah, they should definitely use new in there. They should call it the new Wii U tablet.
Well, technically,
why are they so shit at names?
I don't know, but that actually dovetails very nicely in what we're going to talk about is. What do you blame Nintendo's problems on?
far as the Wii U is concerned.
Yeah. What do you blame most for the Wii U struggles? And I think, as I have maintained from the time the system was announced, that Wii is even in the name.
Yeah.
That's part of it. I think the two biggest factors for them is there's a lack of identity.
Mm-hmm.
And coming in, frankly, the Wii U in a lot of ways was a half measure. It if they had followed up the Wii with what it sounds like the NX is going to be, that would have been the jump that I would have been looking for. And instead, what they did is they gave us a subpar, mini, fucked up, weird tablet controller with an underpowered console. And it just didn't work on, like, pretty much all fronts. They had a gimmick that nobody really wanted to take advantage of, which is really funny because they were coming off, they're coming off of a generation where they're still in dealing with two screens with software. Like, they could have changed, the Wii U could have been playing 3DS games, it could have been playing DS games, it could have been taking those titles that were on DS and making bigger versions of them and making that kind of interaction. Instead, usually the bottom screen was only a map screen, or you used it for off TV play. And that proposition at $350 when the PlayStation 4 was $400 was ridiculous. If it had launched at $199, I think we would have been in a different, we'd be having a very different conversation. I don't think it would have sold. I still think it would have sold poorly in the way that it did here, but I think they would have moved a lot more units because at that point, a $350 price point was kind of insulting for what you got.
Especially now, with the launch.
Yeah, exactly. No, with the launch lineup and everything. I mean, Nintendo has just, Nintendo's biggest problem isn't just their hardware anymore. It's that they act like they're not in a race. They act like they're not competing. And they have to be at least somewhat aware of who they're up against. And they're out to lunch. And then the Wii U's problems just compounded on itself. Like, it was underpowered. It was overpriced. There was absolutely nothing there that could have gotten people to do a lot of digital purchases because their account system is flawed at best and insulting at worst. Like, I mean, this was a console that would have worked in 2004 or 2006, not in 2012 when it launched, 2013, and not at that price point. That was the biggest problem. They could have created an identity for it even after it launched, but instead it was just the also-ran console. And that sucks because it had some good software on it, but, I mean, it's been the same thing that Nintendo has done for years. It's you buy a Nintendo console for Nintendo games, and I'm not going to buy a Nintendo console for Nintendo games anymore at $350.
No.
Yeah, like, the big problem that was with the Wii U was just, sort of like we were talking about with Street Fighter V, it wasn't ready at launch. Mm-hmm. There were big things that weren't ready. The store wasn't really ready. Yeah. It was like all the virtual console stuff wasn't there until like March after launch. And it's like that was the same problem with the 3DS. The store wasn't really there until several months later on the following year. Whereas like the Wii Shop was ready at launch. It was ready to go. It wasn't necessarily the greatest, but it was there if you wanted to buy stuff.
And going back to that talk about it being a half-step console, that speaks more to their handling of the Wii, I would say, because the Wii was a get-out-of-jail-free card for everything that had plagued them up to that point. I mean, they were suddenly drowning in money. You can't be the little guy after something like that anymore. Yes, Sony's in the market. Microsoft's in the market. But with a victory like the Wii, where they are just raking in cash wholesale, okay, now you have the money that you need to compete with them on a hardware level, and they didn't seem to want to invest that. They were too tentative.
With the Wii, they had the marketing pretty much on point from the start. Yeah. With the whole revolution stuff, you could see all the people that bought into that. Whereas with the Wii U, everybody's like, we're just like, what? What's going on? Is that like the Wii? What is this, the controller?
Is this just an add-on for the Wii?
That's part of the problem. Like, a big part of the reason why the Wii was lightning in a bottle was is that you were able to get people to purchase it that didn't really play video games, and that was combined with the fact that the control scheme made sense. You pointed something and it moved. You know, I mean, they basically made a remote control that had buttons on it, just like a remote control has, but they also made it an actual physical controller for a video game system. And they made it intuitive. And the Wii U has none of that. And you can see them also holding on to the Wii tech, like, okay, well, we got to have this in here. And it was just, it felt very much like a half measure to me. And I think that it was done because people were just like, what was it, a couple months ago? Didn't they just say they just expected people to buy it? Or was that Sony? I can't remember.
I think it was one of their execs that was sort of setting numbers that they were going to expect was.
Yeah. And with just no, and we talk about this so many times in the show, it's like these managers and these corporate folks are just out to lunch. Like, why would you think that this would work? Especially, and that goes back to the whole idea of them not competing. The reason that Microsoft and Sony haven't put out a tablet system is because everybody's already got tablets. You don't have to do that. And, like, at least with the NX, they're looking at the NX being a tablet. At least it looks like it will actually be a real tablet instead of a controller that has a big fucking screen in it. You know, Sony or Microsoft went with Smart Glass. With Sony, you can use the Vita as a second screen if you want to. But none of that was... Microsoft didn't build the Xbox One around Smart Glass. Sony didn't build the PS4 around the Vita. And that's kind of what Nintendo did. And it feels like a half measure, like I said, now that we see what they're doing with the NX, or at least what we think they're doing with the NX. That should have been the Wii U in the first place. Not with the, and there's no reason it couldn't have been, because the tech was there then. But Nintendo is so conservative, and they want to make boatloads of money off of their hardware. Let's not forget, this is the same guys that launched the original 3DS at $250.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, it's, you got a problem when your controller is probably more expensive than the actual box that's running it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, for the record, and we just want to say this, we're being really negative here, but as far as the NX is concerned, there are some good signs.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm up in the air right now about the NX. I mean, I'm hopeful for it, but it's really just a matter of, I don't know. I'm kind of at the point now with a lot of this stuff, games, companies, everything else like that, where I'm just sort of operating out of the idea that the people running the place are dumb, and they're not going to actually kind of do what I would like. So I kind of have to take this wait and see approach, because there is, I don't know what it is when you start fucking around with the stock market that makes you lose your goddamn mind, but that's kind of what we've seen happen. We talk about this all the time. We saw the middle fall out of the game industry, you know, because everyone was so obsessed with Call of Duty numbers that then would drive the stock higher, and it led companies like THQ to suicide by creating things like UDraw and everything else. That we watched what happened with Mad Catz, because they were banking on a revival of peripheral games. Like, this is not the way people are doing business anymore, and I feel like a lot of these companies are making their decisions in a vacuum, and then they get out onto the market, and then they blame the people for not understanding what they were trying to do, when it's like, that's not how this works. You're supposed to make something that people want to buy, not blame them when you fuck it up and then say it's their fault that they didn't get it. Like, I remember Greg Miller said that on one of his podcasts, like, oh, well, the public failed the Vita. Fuck you. Come on. Mm-hmm. Like, Sony fucked this up. And here's the thing. I love the Vita. But Sony did everything wrong from the fucking launch except for the fucking hardware. They stuck those horrible proprietary memory cards in there that added, at a minimum, $80 if you wanted a decent memory card to the overall price of the system. They designed it in the way that they designed the PS4, where you have to install fucking games. Like, it's the antithesis of what an actual piece of portable hardware is supposed to do. It did all of the wrong things. And the only reason that it's still going is because there's enough people that are into niche titles that will do it. Sony itself has abandoned it. And that was just one of those things. It was a poor decision because the company was like, we have to get greedy. Nintendo got greedy with wanting to put, if they had put that system out at $199, it'd be a different fucking story. It still would have been third place, but we would not be having these conversations now. Sony was the same way. If they put out the Vita at the $250 price point, which was good, and then you could just use micro SD cards, be a very different story. But when you pad in that price, when you get over that $300 range, that's when people go, wait a minute. I mean, like, I sold mobile phones for years, guys, and the magic price point for phones is $199. You saw a 70% price drop in sales for phones that were above $199. That is the hardware like trigger point for a lot of people, unless that hardware does multiple things. And portable hardware doesn't do a lot of things, and neither does home console software that won't play Blu-rays or anything else like that. You cannot get people to pay more than $200 for it unless it does a bunch of other shit. That's one of the reasons why Microsoft did what they did with the Xbox One and thought they could get away with a $500 price point.
Yeah, the Wii U and 3DS seem like they were designed like 2009, 2010 when 3D TVs were big and when the iPad was trying to take over the world.
Yeah.
And so they said, hey, we need to put these in our new consoles.
Yeah.
And both of them kind of failed to the point where Nintendo eventually released a 3D, a 2DS that lacked the 3D and just priced it as, oh, this is the kid's safe one. And also didn't have like the, was just like a solid tablet looking thing.
Yeah.
And the Wii U just kind of had this, oh, people like iPads, let's make a console that incorporates that while also being hardcore enough to have these two sticks, all these buttons, and all this. That's going to confuse the people that normally use iPads because they don't want any of this other crap on there. Because they'll look at that and see, like, what the hell's all this? What do I do with this thing? Just want to chuck it into a river.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that the demographic that bought the Wii, they moved to mobile.
Yeah.
Those people aren't coming back. Like, because the other thing about mobile, say what you want about it, but it's real simple to actually get into unless you're looking at some super complex game. You don't have to be a hardcore person to figure out how to play a mobile game.
Yeah, the DS and the Wii drew all those people in, and then when iPhone and Android came out, like, see you later.
Yeah.
This is even simpler for us.
Yeah.
Which is why I said Nintendo should have played that card differently and used all that Wii money to get caught up in the hardware race as far as being able to R&D powerful consoles that can compete with what companies like Sony and Microsoft can bring to the table, when that was a legitimate problem for Nintendo before the Wii. But with all the money that they raked in on the Wii, they didn't really have an excuse anymore, and they fumbled on that.
Yeah.
The Wii was kind of in a bad spot at that time because it was a couple years before the PS4 and Xbox One, and they weren't going to do something that would compete with that early. That would have been so much money just to get that sort of thing out.
Yeah.
Well before Sony and Microsoft, and obviously they weren't going to wait until that was more feasible.
Well, the other part of it too is you have to remember when we're talking about this with Nintendo acts like third parties are irrelevant. And I think we've hit the point where you can, if you go on forums or anything else like that, I think that you still see people go, exclusives are why I buy consoles. But I don't think that's actually the way that it works for the majority of the gaming public now. They want to play where their friends are. They're tied into an ecosystem. They want to have the biggest access to the largest selection of games that they can get. And that's the big thing that pushes it. So I think that's the other part that's been really difficult for Nintendo, because if consoles sold just on exclusives, the Wii U should be number one. Because I think in terms of first-party exclusives, it's probably got the most quality lineup. But yet, it's at the very bottom. And that's because people want to be able to play other things. They want to have a wide variety of things that they can play. That is the thing that made the DS successful. Was, yes, you had all of these great Nintendo games, but saying that that was the reason that it was successful is incredibly short-sighted because of how much other stuff was on there, you know?
You had your Professor Layton's, your Phoenix Wrights.
Any kind of game that came out, yeah, all the RPGs. I mean, all the stuff that was there is what made it successful. And it was scaled in a way that even if you didn't sell that much, you could still be successful. And look at the console generations now. I mean, you have the current console generation. You have Sony and Microsoft opening up these avenues for people that could never, ever put out a physical copy of anything. You know, Dan Adelman, who's come on our show, would...
Well,
10
we're
years
still
ago,
working on that.
Well, what I'm saying is 10 years ago, any of those guys that we've been talking to would not have had these opportunities. And they're happening because of Microsoft and because of Sony. They're not happening because of Nintendo or anybody else at that. Nintendo's getting dragged along with everybody else, you know, and that they need to get to a point where they start to go, okay, this is where gaming is shifted. Like, there's a point where being this conservative is going to kill you, and I think they've hit that point. Yeah. So, you know, I'm really hoping that they turn it around, because all of the old stuff they banked on doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
It just doesn't.
And hopefully it works out in the end, because, as we've said on the show before, gaming is better when Nintendo's taking an active role in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, yep. If Nintendo gets out of the market, then, you know, Sega's not getting back into making consoles. No. That's never going to happen. That's
essentially will be the death of an era.
You know? Yeah. So.
Yeah. And to rewind about 10 minutes to that bit about us pointing out that we're not being negative about the NX, I don't think we can really be positive or negative about the NX in any meaningful way. Until because,
I mean, there's really nothing has been confirmed about it.
Yeah. As of, you know, we have rumors right now, and the technical stuff that I've seen so far is very, very promising, in the sense that if they're actually aiming it as a mobile-first platform that will dock, they have something that basically has more power than... well, pretty much every mobile device out there right now.
Yes.
You know, power-wise, it's got the development systems are running on the NVIDIA Tegra X1, which just destroys pretty much every mobile GPU that's out there.
Unless all they need.
Yeah. And it's not going to be running at a super high resolution like most phones are.
No, probably running 720p.
You try to run any intensive games and your battery power dies in like an hour.
Yeah. You know, and the final, you know, shipping hardware might actually have the newer GPU, the P1. So that could, you know, benefit the NX, you know, substantially there as far as power draw goes.
Yeah, I thought sure we were going to be hearing about it at Gamescom. That didn't happen. Maybe TGS.
Yeah, I think they've got to start
talking about it soon if they're launching in March.
Yeah, I think September is like the rumored reveal time.
Yeah, they're going to start trickling information out now because, it's about time. If you're going to launch the system in March, you better tell people what it is.
Yeah, they're on the clock now.
Yeah.
And also, I just wanted to point out that the people in the industry who have seen what Nintendo is working with right now that aren't part of Nintendo,
they're piling up endorsements.
Yeah. We've gotten endorsements from CD Projekt Red. We've gotten them from EA.
Bethesda had something to say.
Bethesda.
Yeah. If you want to see what the NX games could potentially look like on a TV right now, get an NVIDIA Shield.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the same tech. So.
And the reason I bring up EA and CD Projekt and Bethesda is because it means that Nintendo is trying to reach back out to third-party support again.
Oh, they've tried.
It's not been for lack of effort.
It's been keeping them. That's been the problem. Mm-hmm. Getting them there.
And now we've got, you know, good endorsements from some of the major players, so...
Yeah.
And the good thing for them is that Sony and Microsoft aren't ready to release like the next generation. They're releasing like half steps up.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. they shouldn't be completely blown out of the water, you know, six months after they're releasing their console.
Mm. Yeah. They're also like approaching it in a different fashion too. So
this could also be Nintendo's entry into the TikTok model. I mean, it would be very much like Nintendo to not sync their TikTok up with their competitors.
Yeah, yeah.
So, in a way, it seems almost fitting.
But I could see that working in the sense of an NX form factor, which would be, you know, more of a handheld thing that you dock. You really only need to replace just the head unit itself. You wouldn't need to replace all the ancillary stuff. Mm. So, there's that. That's cool. Anyways, I think we got a show for this week, guys.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. So, Yeah, this week I'm moving. I should be home. Well, I should be online on Friday for Let's Weekend. So if I'm online for that show, that means there will be another Days of Arrow update on the Sunday following. Yeah. If not, well...
For the record, if he's not here for Let's Weekend, then that show is probably not going to happen.
Yeah.
So,
because, listen, if you think I sound bad now, Bill is the edit wizard who makes me sound somewhat legible.
Yeah. He turns into a robot in his off hours.
Yeah.
He is Mr. Robot. So with that, I'm Filippo D'Onofrio.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Brandon Parkin.
I'm Chris Elogi.
And I'm Lee Lamb.
And we'll possibly see you next week.